Welcome to Author Voices On Air, and I'm your host, Rick Bell. The title of our next book is The Apostle of Love from Londonistan. The Apostle of Love tells the imaginary story of a long-distance relationship between two people as it grows, falters at times, and finally ends in marriage. The relationship unravels within the context of a world where love is being starved of oxygen by the political and religious delusions of a humanity that refuses to recognise the existential need for change. The Apostle of Love believes he can save the world and calls for a new pagan spiritual consciousness that will equip us and inspire us to avoid Armageddon. Joining me now to give us an insight into this love story with a difference is the author Lee Huxley. Welcome, Lee. Thank you for joining us.
It's great to talk to you, Rick. I've been looking forward to it.
Now, this book, as I mentioned during my introduction, is very much a love story. It's about a long-distance relationship, but not a love story in the conventional sense. So without giving too much away, tell us the story behind the story, how you came up with the idea for the book, and how that idea became the book that we're talking about today.
Well, it's really a book about two parallel love stories, my love for a woman and my love for the world. And I really was trying to save a woman from poverty and save the world from imminent Armageddon. So I had these two parallel projects. And the love story, as you say, is not conventional. It starts off as really a story about how I try to help a girl who is in the Philippines. And I met her in a bar, and she was a dancer. And we formed a relationship. I went home and to London, and we talked on Facebook. And I decided to get her out of the bars for reasons which I will explain later. And what I found was that she had no means of support, because they don't have much of a welfare system out in the Philippines. And I didn't really think about the consequences of taking this lovely girl out of the bars and her not having any means of support. So I decided, you know, I had a responsibility to support her. But the tragic thing was that I didn't really have the financial means to do so. So the story is about how our relationship grows, how at times I just couldn't afford to help her. And I actually finished the relationship, you know, because it was just too taxing on my financial situation. And then we would reunite. And this went on and off for like, you know, 8 years until we had a reunion, which I described in the book. And by then I was really beginning to love her. And we eventually decided to get married. That's the short answer to why I wrote the book. But as I'm describing my relationship with her, it has a context, a kind of global geopolitical context, whereby I'm describing the world around me in turmoil, a world where love is losing its battle against evil, and it's becoming increasingly hard to make love the victor in this almost, you know, metaphysical existential battle that's going on in the world today, you know, where we should be at a much greater point of civilization, where we're building the best of all possible worlds, and we seem to be in the worst of all possible worlds, where we could blow ourselves up at any moment. And so the story is about two parallel forms of love, you know, my love for this girl and my love for a world that seems to be dying. And how love is a crying heart, and that's the image on the book. Love, the my girlfriend is a crying heart in a heartless world, and her struggle is also related to mine, because I have my dreams, she had her dreams, and her dream was shattered. And in a sense, the book ends on a pessimistic note, because my dream is shattered too. Out of the two projects, I am successful with Althea, the girl. I managed to save our love and nurture it, and it has fruition in marriage, but I cannot save the world. I come to the conclusion that there is just too much darkness and denialism and apathy to really make the necessary changes, because everybody wants the world to change, but they're only prepared to do social tinkering. You can't save this planet, social tinkering. You need huge, huge changes.
And that,
you need a sea change.
Yeah, and that brings me conveniently to my next question. Well, it's a question in two parts, really. And the first part is, who did you write the book for? Who was your intended readership and why? And secondly, it is most definitely a book, a story, a love story with a lesson, something to teach the listener. So in answering that question in two parts, who did you write the book for, and what do you hope the reader will learn and take away from reading your book?
I wrote the book for free thinkers, for people who can, to coin a phrase, think outside the box, for people who, when faced with good logical arguments, are prepared to abandon their cherished beliefs in order to discover, you know, the truth. And my target audience also included people of religious faith, especially women, because my email is Pagan Preacher. You know, I am a preacher, and I'm a pagan, and I'm preaching back to people of religious faith, just as they preach to me, and I have a right to do that. And I'm trying to, just as they're trying to convert me to their faith, I'm trying to convert them to rationalism and science and to a new understanding of love that is not based on retribution, because it's not conditional, because religious faith purports to be about love, but it threatens people with eternal damnation, which I think is contradictory to love. I mean, the message of Christianity and Islam is, you know, you must accept faith or you will be punished because you've done a terrible thing by not accepting the faith. So it was targeted greatly at women, because I feel that women have, or feminism has identified the main problem on this planet, which is toxic masculinity. If you look at Putin, for example, or Kim of North Korea, they are examples of toxic masculinity, of almost, you know, pathological narcissism, where they're prepared to sacrifice thousands of people to stay in power. And the feminist revolution is really all about combating patriarchy, and it's lost the battle. It's come to a halt. It's really facing the immense task of trying to remove people like Putin from power. It's lost hope. And I want my book to galvanize women, you know, to take this issue head on. Like the Greenham Common women who 40 years ago came down from Wales, just ordinary housewives. They came down from Wales and campaigned outside an American missile base. And they stayed there for 20 years, and they made all sorts of personal sacrifices. And the British government regarded them as pests. And they were campaigning for world peace, and they were campaigning against patriarchy and male aggression. And we need to rekindle that spirit. So that's you know, my target audience, anyone who's prepared to think radically and to realize that to change the world, we need to do some big things. And I base a lot of my philosophy on the song Imagine by John Lennon. It provides a kind of substrate for me to build a lot of my ideas. The genius of this song is that it identified the three things that are really holding humanity back. And these are selfish, greedy capitalism. Capitalism is great. It's served its purpose now. It's out of date. You cannot unite the peoples of this planet on greed. The other thing he identified was tribal nationalism. Just look at the war in the Ukraine. It's about land. It's about tribal nationalism. Very similar to the war in Gaza. And the third thing he identified, perhaps the most important thing that we need to address, is not the elimination of religion. There's nothing wrong with people believing in God. I'm not an atheist. But what he identified specifically was heaven and hell in his song Imagine. Because heaven and hell is about, it's a form of apartheid. It's a form of segregation where one group of people demonize another group of people outside their religion and say that they deserve to go to hell. In my book, I actually come up with a very radical idea, which I'm sure will offend some people, but I'm the apostle of love. It's love, but it's tough love. And I beg Christians and Muslims and Judaists, and especially religious women, I say, you know, look at this idea of demonizing people outside your religion. It's a form of hate speech, you know, and yet when you criticize religion, you or I am criticized of hate speech. But it's actually, I'm trying to expose hate speech, because the definition of hate speech is demonizing people, bad-mouthing people outside your group. And a Christian basically says, you know, if you don't accept the offer of salvation from Jesus Christ, you've done something terribly wrong, and you will be punished, because hell is a punishment, and you will be tortured forever in hell. And so I try to make women especially understand, look, this God, you know, is a macho God. He's an aggressive God. You know, he tortures women in hell. Half the people in hell, half the denizens of hell are going to be women. And if I might just add quickly, my philosophy is also based on a marvelous feminist theologian called Mary Daly, who most people have not heard about, because she is very anti-religion, because she thinks that it's unfit for women because it's so misogynistic. And she actually says, and I know this is going to really alarm some people, but she actually says that in her mind, you know, Jesus is not coming back. The second coming is not happening, but there will be a coming. And that is feminism reinventing itself as the Antichrist, as to say to women, look, you must not take hand-me-downs from men. You must not accept these ready-made religions from men. You have to be free thinkers and find your own concept of God, your own relationship with God, that has nothing to do with holy books that just were invented to control women and especially control their sexuality.
Well, that's certainly a very powerful message. And it is, without question, a powerful book and so much more than just a love story. Now, earlier on, you mentioned to me off air, we talked about the fact that this is one of a number of books that you've written, and we will get the chance to talk about the other books a little bit later on. But let's talk about when you sat down to write this book, because it is, as we mentioned, it does have a degree of controversy within it. It is a book with a powerful message, and it is a love story. So tell me about some of the challenges and some of the hurdles that you faced and had to overcome when you were researching and writing this particular book.
Well, I get my knowledge from books. You know, I'm surrounded by books now as I'm speaking to you, most of them theology, philosophy books. But I'm also a great believer in immediate knowledge. And I get that from looking at rolling news. So I look at, you know, Al Jazeera, the BBC, ITV, all the channels. And I've I've been a witness to some of these, you know, epic events in history. For example, when Trump tried to destroy democracy, and there was that raid, and I watched it unfolding on my television in real time, and I could hardly believe it. And the same with all these events that I describe in the book. I've witnessed them firsthand. And so there's a kind of immediacy, an immediacy about it, and a kind of honesty about it. And the relationship I had with Althea, maybe I should just say a little bit more about how it happened. We kind of met by a freak chance, because I was in the bar, and I saw this very, very beautiful girl, and she's got Spanish blood. So she's Filipino and she's Spanish. And I invited her for a drink. And I should also mention that my spirituality is based in Tantra, Tantric Buddhism and Tantric Hinduism. And in this metaphysic, prostitution is not considered something bad. In the Eastern view of sex, it's all about yin and yang, and it's much more a health issue. And so if sex is considered, you know, good for the health, and you balance yin and yang, and it's a gateway to experiencing life in a much fuller sense, then prostitution is a way of democratizing it. And that's a huge issue, and, you know, we can't really get into it. But I bought this girl a drink, and we had an immediate rapport. She actually had an argument with her mama-san, because and this is where it's the way your life can be radically changed by tiny events. A Korean guy had booked her for the night, and he turned up late. And so she was talking to me, and she preferred me to the Korean guy. And she told her mama-san that she didn't want to go with this Korean guy. So we went back to the hotel together. And if the Korean guy had turned up on time, I would never have met Althea. And so from that moment, you know, we were kind of in a way destined to be together. And as I say, she was very, very, very poor. And eventually I paid for her to build a little hut in Leyte, with her relatives. They were staying in this village. And this poor girl, you know, was living in this hut all by herself with no mod cons or anything. And I was desperate to try and, you know, improve her situation. And for years she lived in this hut, and I just couldn't, you know, afford to get her a better accommodation. And so our love was really tested, you know. But as I say, it has a happy ending.
And obviously, a love that was tested for a very good reason, and as you say, had a happy ending. And you mentioned there that fate brought you together, and I picked up that as a strong message from the story and from the book, is that some things in life are just destined to be.
You know, I tried to escape my responsibility because it made me feel like I was a failure. And I felt we were both victims of capitalism. You know, this incredible wealth gap, you know, the frustration of trying to support this woman to the degree that she deserved to be supported. It made me think a lot more about, you know, why I was poor. You know, when I spent my whole life striving to be successful, I started off as an art teacher. And I abandoned my art teaching career to follow my dream to become a rock star. And I joined several rock bands as a singer. And I spent 10 years, you know, in this desperate struggle, like so many rock bands indulge in, trying to get rich and successful. I failed. And then I tried to find fame and fortune through my art. And I was an erotica artist, sort of underground erotica artist. I got on television several times, but one of the problems I had was that I couldn't break through to the really big money, which is on the art scene. because no art critics would take my work seriously because they were terrified of being associated with what they thought was pornography. In other words, the art business cannot tell the difference between pornography and erotica. So I failed on that score as well. So meeting her and failing to support her or marry her, because she always wanted to marry me, reminded me of how, you know, hard life is. And the American dream is quite deceptive, you know, because it spins this yarn that you can be anything you want to be. All you've got to do is work hard. You know, it's the work ethic, the American work ethic. And it's just not true. So many people, you know, struggle. So many rock bands have struggled. So many artists have struggled. So many writers have struggled. And they don't get that lucky break, you know, and they don't know the right people. And they end up, you know, just really quite disillusioned with life. And so every time I failed to support her, I felt a failure myself. And I felt the weight of, you know, capitalism when all around me, money seemed to be being wasted, you know, on buying bombs and weapons and you know, think of the money that is spent on arming nations and the arms race. And all that money, you know, could be used for a much better use if we found a way of uniting as a species. So one of the slogans I have is, you know, healthcare, not warfare, you know. And right now, for example, I'm struggling to get the money together to marry her in the Philippines. I'm going in June. And the war is going on in Gaza. And I'm hearing about these ridiculous bombs that are costing thousands and thousands of dollars that they're just dropping on Gaza, killing children. You know, it's like, it's completely insane, the money that is wasted on wars and weaponry, the arms race, you know, when the NHS is struggling and millions of people have health problems and terminal illnesses, you know, that need to be, we need to find a cure for these illnesses. We need money for research. And it's one of the great tragedies of the world today that everywhere money is being thrown away on aggression and war instead of peace and love. And so you know, it's a tough world to live in. And I'm the apostle of love. I believe in love, and I'm doing everything I can.
And you said, you're certainly very passionate about it, and that is absolutely clear and quite right too. Now, I mentioned earlier on, and sorry for moving off the topic of this book just for a moment, but I mentioned earlier on that this is not the only book that you've written. You've actually written 6 books. Tell us just a little bit about the other books that you have written.
They're quite varied. The first book I ever wrote was actually published, you know, by a proper publisher, and it was called Martial Dance. And I was a black belt in karate. Well, I suppose I'm still a black belt in karate, even though I don't train now. And I became very interested in putting over a form of dance that included martial arts movements. And so I invented my own martial dance. And I was a bit ahead of my time, in as much as I wanted the dance, I wanted it to be more dance than aerobics. But the fad of the time was aerobics. My book went to America, and not long after my book went to America, Americans were coming out with books on and videos on martial aerobics. So I really kind of missed the jackpot there, because my book was more about the spiritual side of the martial arts and of Budo, the way of the warrior, and it wasn't orientated towards, you know, burning off calories and getting super fit. And so I kind of missed the jackpot there, but I do believe that I was one of the pioneers of the martial dance movement, martial aerobics. I also wrote a book with a very, very provocative title called God is Sex. And it was about my art, my erotic art. And the title sounds, you know, a bit silly, but it's based on Tantra, where in Buddhist Tantra and Hindu Tantra, God is actually conceived as sex. It's conceived in the form of a statue or a statuette called a yabyam, and it depicts Buddha in a sexual position with his wife. And in Hinduism, it depicts the god Shiva in a sexual position with Shakti. And it symbolizes bliss, and it symbolizes how the universe was created, you know, when the god Shiva had sexual union with Shakti, and the universe emerged from her yoni or her vagina. So whereas in Christianity, for example, the image of Christianity, the icon, the iconic image is suffering on a cross. In Tantra, the image is of love and bliss, purification of sexual love. So my art celebrated this idea of, you know, God being symbolized as not just charity, which is the Christian idea, but of sexual love and sexual union. And that when sex is meaningful, it's called maithuna in Tantra, sex becomes a gateway to love of the universe. So love of the universe and love of life actually starts with love of your partner and your sexual loving experience, which was Sex and the Devil's Wager. And the reason I included sex in the title is because when people are talking about religion, they always want to divorce it from sex, and you can't, because all our ideas about sex have been conditioned by religious faith. And every religion condemns prostitution as fornication, which is, you know, the worst kind of sex. And so it's colored all our ideas and our attitudes to sex workers in our society. And I also wrote about hell in this book, because it's a subject I've been absolutely fascinated with all my life. And I believe the whole world is suffering from hell denialism. It's a form of cognitive dissonance where people cannot see. They hold two contradictory ideas in their mind, and it doesn't seem to bother them. They hold the idea in their mind that God is love and kindness, and at the same time, this God is a very angry God who punishes people. And there's actually been a book published by the Church of England, which I quote in my book, where the church, our national religion, actually refers to the God of Hellfire as a quote-unquote sadistic monster. And so the Church of England tends to reject the idea of hell and says hell is just a grave where people go, they die, and the good people go to heaven, but the bad people don't go to hell. Or rather, the unbelievers don't go to hell as a place of punishment. They just go to the grave. So even the Church of England has described this conventional God, this typical God of religious faith, as a sadistic monster. And yet people just will not recognize it. You know, all the governments of the world just look upon religion as not having a dark side. They won't talk about the dark side, and they won't talk about this cognitive dissonance, where it's a complete paradox, a God of love who tortures people. It's absurd. And if I might just say one more thing, I'm sorry if I sound like I'm ranting. Like you say, I'm so passionate about this. But if I could just say that torture was made it legal in Britain in the 17th century. Morally good, terrible tortures, and it's good. How come it's torture is wrong in this world, but it's right in the next? And people really do believe in physical torture. When I'm busking, I sometimes get cards put in my guitar case where I'm collecting the money from Christian groups warning me that if I don't convert, I will have to suffer the most terrible torments in the afterlife. So many, many people, millions of people, do believe in this place where we are physically tortured for just disbelief. And this paradox is just ignored by all the politicians. Most of the politicians in the West are religious. Iraq, Iran, run by Muslims, you know, Europe is basically Christian. Britain is Christian. America is definitely Christian. Every president is Christian. Most of our prime ministers are Christians, and none of them will face this paradox. And I'm trying to wake people up. So I've written Sex and the Devil's Wager, and now I've written The Apostle of Love. And in every one of my books, I try and say, look, you know, the God of hellfire is old-fashioned. It's out of date. We need to move on, and we need to find a God of humanity that serves the whole of humanity, God of love, that is non-conditional love, unconditional love, where, you know, if you don't join the religion, you're not going to be punished. You're just punishing yourself. So it's a passion with me. And I'm in the book, I end in a rather pessimistic note that religion, hellfire religion, just seems to be getting stronger and stronger on this planet with the revival of Islam, you know, on the petrodollar, and the effect of 9/11 and Charlie Hebdo, where now anybody who dares to criticize religion is gagged, and they're told that they're Christophobic or anti-Semitic or Islamophobic. And one of the great traditions in my country was irreverence. You know, we were allowed to be irreverent. We were allowed to take the mickey out of religion and not get, you know, accused of being fascists. I'm not a fascist. I'm a rationalist. And yet, you know, daring to criticize religion is not acceptable. It's not fashionable. I have never heard a debate in the last 15 years, a serious debate about religion and about God. So we are being dumbed down, because a society must talk about God, because God is a word that means ultimate reality. So in a sense, we should all believe in God, because there is some kind of ultimate reality. But we don't discuss it now, and we don't discuss the difference between spirituality and religion. Our society has become really dumbed down and scared of talking about the big things that adults should be talking about in this world, where we need a spiritual direction, because we're moving towards implosion. And I'm not the only person that's saying that. Most people are talking about, even in the media, they're talking about how, you know, there is a very serious risk of nuclear war at every moment we're talking. And we should not have to live under this Damoclean sword.
Well, thank you.
I'm sorry.
Thank you for those.
I'm the pagan preacher.
Yeah.
The pagan preacher. I do apologize.
That's okay. Well, thank you for those passionate and words, passion that is certainly strong within you. And, you know, you believe in good, basically, is what you're saying. You believe in that is what people need to be, as good. Now, we talked about the main topic of conversation was the book that we're talking about, The Apostle of Love from Londonistan. And that's what we talked about in the main. We've touched on the other books that you've written. But has this inspired you to continue with your writing? And if so, have you written anything else that's not been published yet, or do you have anything in the pipeline, just briefly?
Well, I've only just, you know, finished this book. I've only just had it published, and it was very emotionally draining and took all my time. And when I finished the book, I said, I'm not going to write anything else. Now I've recovered a bit. I want to write a sequel, you know, because the book ends with me deciding to marry this girl. And I've started a whole new journey, which would make a fascinating sequel to the book. So I intend to write the sequel about, you know, how I'm getting on with raising the funds to get married, and some of the strange things, like she's a Christian, she's a Catholic, she wants to get married in a church, and I'm a kind of antichrist, but I'm going to do it for her out of love. You know, I will get married in a church, even though I disagree with everything that she believes in. But, you know, our love conquers our religious differences. And so I'm definitely going to write another book. I've rekindled my hope and my optimism, and maybe I can still save the world.
And you're certainly not someone that gives up. Well, thank you for that. The Apostle of Love in Londonistan is published by Author House, and is available direct from the publisher at authorhouse.com/bookstore and all good bookstockers. Well, a man who is passionate about his love and passionate about the teachings of this book and his own personal message. I'd like to thank once again my guest today, the author Lee Huxley. Many thanks, Lee.
Thank you, Rick. It's been great talking to you.
Likewise. This is Rick Bell for Toginet Radio 2.0. Thank you for listening.